Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
As I sit here, approaching retirement age to my humble existence, another October rears its ugly head to greet me. Every year seems to bring forth another movie or TV show about demons and devils, ghosts, monsters, poltergeists, witches, you name it, it's on the big screen. And every year it reminds me of those horrible months I spent at the Trenton House, and the tumult it caused. I have been raised in a Catholic household. We went to church on Sundays, I volunteered whatever I could, helping the local clergy with the local programs and outreach. Then came time for college, which I used to study teaching, and after 4 years in higher education, it came time for me to go back home. Our local pastor, Father Gregory Hopley, was a cordial man well into his 50s once I had come back. Balding and slightly pudgy, he was finding trouble keeping his congregation. Evangelicals dominated the religious scene at the time, and when I came back home and started to volunteer again, many of the social programs that had once been a pillar of the church were now scaled back or cut altogether. Not quite knowing where to go next in my life, I offered to volunteer in my spare time while figuring out my next move. It was under these circumstances that one morning, after Sunday prayer, Father Hopley approached me.
"Brother Colin," he began, pensive, "I have an unusual proposition that I'd hope you take me up on."
What is it, Father?" I asked, expecting some sort of flyer campaign or a school speaking event aimed at getting more people.
"There's a woman who's been coming around lately," he began, "and she's been asking for special help with her son. You see, he's been troubled for some time now, and she's taken him to see all sorts of doctors and psychiatrists and the like, but nothing has helped." He paused to see if it was sinking in with me yet.
My confusion must have been evident, because he stated it bluntly with his next sentence.
"Brother Colin, she's asking for someone to perform an exorcism." The words chilled my blood and made my throat dry. The thought that the devil could be staking his claim around my hometown was like hearing Jeffrey Dahmer was your next-door neighbor.
"Okay," I said, unsure of how to respond.
"What are you going to do? You have to conduct an investigation first, correct? Will the Vatican approve?"
"I'm afraid," he told me, "I'm going to have to expedite the process somehow. I've conducted a preliminary investigation on my own, so having completed it, I'll be proceeding with the exorcism right away." I was floored.
"Father, you can't do that," I implored. "There's rules, regulations. You could get in a lot of trouble if anybody found out."
"I understand that, Brother Colin," he said, frowning. "But I am prepared to take that risk. We cannot have bureaucrats in Rome dithering while a young man could need our help now."
"We?" I said.
"Yes, we,"
Hopley said.
"I want you to assist me in this matter, Colin."
I sighed, looking off to the side, prompting him to quickly add,
"Now, hear me out now.
You've taught Sunday school here for some time now, and I understand that you're open to priesthood, or perhaps a teaching career in a professional institution.
That is true. I admit it.
So then this is going to be a perfect opportunity for you to face the dangers inherent to priesthood. You are going to face the devil in your lifetime, Brother Colin. It's best that you know how to resist him now, so that you're prepared for the future. It won't even be that complex. All you'll have to do is help to restrain the child, should it come to that, and say a few prayers in tandem with me.
This was far too much to take in at once. Again, my emotions must have been evident, because upon sensing my hesitation, he baited a hook I couldn't ignore.
Brother Colin, if you can assist me in this matter, I can provide for you a powerful reference for a future career, be it in the seminary or as a teacher. If you cannot assist me, I shall understand your reservations, but I will have to be honest with potential employees as to your character.
I bit down on my lower lip. All right, Father, I'll help you with this business. He smiled and gave me a pat on the shoulder, told me the time, the place, and what to memorize in advance. In hindsight, it struck me as unusual that a church volunteer would be entrusted with such a responsibility. It was a sweltering day in August when we drove down to the Trenton house. It was fairly far out of town, a good 40-minute drive, flanked by tall fields of grass and a proud tree growing in the back. The house itself was a single-story building, painted in eggshell white, with a dusty dirt path forming the driveway, domed with gray shingles and a brick chimney protruding from the roof. We pulled into the driveway, disembarked, and Father Hopley rapped his knuckles on the door. The door opened moments later to reveal a woman well into middle age, with a big clump of curled hair dyed red on her head, wearing glossy red lipstick and mascara on her eyelids. Perfume and hairspray scent wafted into my nostrils. She pulled back her dry lips into a smile as she greeted us.
"Well, hello there, gentlemen. Glad you decided to come after all,"
Marguerite Trenton said, shaking each of our hands.
"Do come in. Wipe your feet on the mat."
In front of us was an archway that led into the kitchen, and next to that there was a red sofa up against the living room wall, facing the television. There was a tall lamp in the corner, and to its right sat a green recliner. Past the recliner and directly to our right was the hallway that led down to the bathroom and bedrooms. On our left was the fireplace, where a few framed photographs of happier times stood.
"You gentlemen just take a seat anywhere. Could I get you something to eat or drink?"
Marguerite asked us, waving her arm towards the seats.
"No, thank you, ma'am," Father Hopley said, sitting on the sofa. "How's your boy doing?"
Marguerite unsuccessfully tried to hide a grimace, sitting to Hopley's right.
"I've tried to help that boy. You both know that. I wouldn't have asked if I hadn't tried everything. I mean, everything."
"Yes, of course, ma'am," Hopley said. "Would you mind going over that again? I know we already had a conversation about this, but it would help to get a refresher. And my assistant here,"
he said, pointing a thumb towards me,
"hasn't heard the full story for himself."
"Okay, Father,"
she said, taking a moment to swallow.
"I'll start from the beginning."
So we listened to her go over a condensed version of her child's life history. His father passing away when the kid was only 5, had no history of outbursts or odd behavior until 6 months ago, went to all kinds of psychiatrics and doctors and such without any progress. I didn't pay much attention as much as I should have, and made a few remarks, figuring that since Hopley had already conducted a private investigation, my input was unnecessary. There was one thing that caught my attention, though.
"Lately I've had to lock him in his room to make sure he doesn't do too much damage,"
she said. You lock him in? I asked.
Unfortunately,
she said, frowning.
Do you see this?
She said, pointing to a spot in the wall where the blue paints looked fresher, brighter.
He punched a hole there during one of his episodes. Had to get it fixed. It's terrible, I know, but there isn't anything else I can do.
You still care for him, though, of course? Hopley asked.
Of course, whenever I can. A lot of times he just won't eat anything at all. It's awful. It really is.
And so the conversation, monologue, really, went on. Once it was over, I asked where the kid was being kept.
Oh, sure thing. He's in the first door down the hall. You want to see him now, then?
We nodded. She handed us the key to his room and volunteered to help if trouble arose. So off the three of us went. Before we even opened the door, we could smell him. It was a sweaty, rotten smell, like dead fish, armpits, and human feces, all commingling. When we opened it up, the smell was so overpowering I thought I would gag. I had no idea how Father Hopley kept his composure, but he went in like it was nothing. So I grit my teeth and followed in after. James was sitting in the middle of the room, cross-legged, shirtless, hunched over, his back facing us. Black hair was growing unkempt and wild down towards his shoulders. And you could see his emaciated frame puff up and deflate with every breath. Father Hopley came up to the boy, approaching the kid's left side, and crouched down to speak to him, while I stayed about 2 feet away.
Hello, James,
he said. He waited for James to react, but there was nothing. No indication that the boy even knew he was there. So he continued.
I'm here to help you, understand? Me and my friend and your mother, we're here to help.
He rested a hand on the kid's shoulder, which caused the kid to crick his head in Hopley's direction. The kid threw his head back and made this horrible, awful wail. It reminded me of a time when I was passing by a car crash where I lived in the city, and firemen were pulling an older man out of the wreck, both legs mangled and bloody. The kid leapt up from his position, with both arms outstretched, shrieking some more. James punched, kicked, and shoved both of us. I went straight into the wall behind us, pain jolting my back. He grabbed my hair, trying to wrestle his grip off of me. I caught a glimpse of Father Hopley grabbing his other arm and putting a cross to his head while reciting the Lord's Prayer. James suddenly broke off his attack and threw himself to the floor, screaming, gurgling, trailing spit everywhere while rolling around in it. James sat up then, speedily crawling over, grabbing Hopley by the leg, and bit his shin. Hopley cried out in pain while me and Marguerite tried to pull James off of him.
Over here, get him on the bed,
Marguerite told us. The three of us dragged the kicking, screaming kid over. All the while, he kept snapping his teeth at us like a hungry crocodile. Miss Trenton got his arms and legs tied to restraints on each bedpost, while me and Hopley kept him pinned down. When I circled around to help administer the exorcism rites, I got a good look at the kid's face. His eyes were a dark green color, hazy and unfocused. His lower lip hung down, drool occasionally dripping down on his chest and shoulder. Grimy stubble permeated his cheeks and chin. Speaking of his chest, I could see his ribs started to poke out from the malnutrition. I grimaced, feeling true pity for the tortured young man. I can't believe how strong such a weak-looking person had been. When the unfortunate business of tying him up was done, the two of us conducted our rites and prayers physically unmolested, Miss Trenton standing by to watch. James bellowed hideous screams and yells, twisting and turning his head all about, huffing and puffing. He peppered his speech with a litany of swear words, curses, blasphemous statements, and other uncouth declarations which I won't repeat. Occasionally we heard a few words of Latin, mostly mortis or mesis. Likewise, James thrashed when Hopley tried to put his hands on the kid's forehead and squirmed at the contact of holy water. This lasted for almost 4 hours, the kid losing steam as we continued. We wrapped things up, and myself and Hopley chatted with the misses of the house for a few minutes, glad to be out of the foul-smelling room.
"I'm sorry you boys had to go through such awfulness," she said.
"Sometimes these things happen," Hopley said.
"So,"
she said, licking her lips,
"did it work?"
"As I've already told you, ma'am, this is an ongoing process," Hopley said. "But do tell us if his behavior improves or changes in a substantial way."
"And when will you be back?"
"A week from now, barring unfortunate circumstances," Hopley replied.
"What if I need you sooner than that?"
she asked. Something about the way she said it, perhaps the undertone of desperation, gave me shivers.
"Just give us a call whenever the need arises, ma'am, and we'll be at your home in a reasonable fashion," Hopley told her, a half-smile adorning his features. She gave us thanks for our understanding and compassion, thanking us again for taking this time out of our days. We got in our car, started driving off, and I felt a sort of disappointment, perhaps best described it. Or maybe it was disquiet, a feeling that something else was at play, and that I was having a hard time seeing it for what it was. Hopley must have picked up on it, because he asked me,
"Not quite what you expected, was it?"
I nodded. "Yes, you're right, Father. I didn't think an exorcism would have involved..." I trailed off. He grinned at that, knowing exactly what I meant.
"Well, Brother Colin, not every exorcism involves hovering beds and heads twisting around like an owl's. I've heard many stories of exorcisms like this one, or of ones where little to nothing happened. Just remember that as we go forward."
Again, I nodded. The disquiet I felt, however, was not eased. I idly wondered how long the process would take. And so began a weekly ritual that's provided to be a physical challenge every day I had to do it. James's outburst never improved during this time, of course. I had feces and urine thrown at me, blood spat in my face, and that's to say nothing of all the bruising I endured and the horrible wrestling we had to do to keep him down. I remember once a kid in my Sunday school classes asked if a bully had given me a black eye I had sustained. The Trenton house had its own oddities that weren't directly related to James on top of this. Dead birds and rodents on the property, the grass yellowing unnaturally, that sort of thing. It made every drive up there more and more ominous. I found it strange how much Miss Trenton was taking all these strange occurrences in stride. I remember wondering if she ever thought about renting some place so that she could at least be closer to people should anything happen. It was about 3 months into James's exorcism when that something did happen. At around 11 o'clock at night on Monday, when I was trying to get to sleep, I got a phone call from Father Hopley. He told me Marguerite had called him up screaming into the receiver about how James was going insane, trashing their home, asking us to come quickly. My tired mind barely comprehending what was happening, I threw my clothes on as quickly as I could, drove down to pick up Hopley, and practically sped to the Trenton house. I kept my reservations about going up there at this point in time to myself. When we got there, we were surprised to see her sitting on the steps to the front door, arms wrapped up in a self-hug.
"Oh, thank God you're here,"
she said, practically mobbing us as we stepped out of the car.
"He's gone berserk, tearing up the whole house. I couldn't do anything.
Miss Trenton, please calm down,
Hopley said.
Where is James now?
The kitchen. Oh, God. He was trying to go for the knives, and then I went out here.
She took many hurried breaths and pressed her eyes closed, as if the memory was too horrible to warrant remembering.
How did you get out?
I inquired.
I don't know,
she said.
The door, it just opened by itself. I couldn't believe it.
Don't worry, ma'am. We will take care of this,
Hopley said, giving her a soothing hug and reassuring pat on the back. I, for one, was incredulous. The kid was dangerous, potentially armed, and we were going in. I thought we would be better served driving to the closest house down and phoning the police. But before I could actually get a word in, Father Hopley pocketed the key to James's room and walked with a purpose towards the front door. Not wanting him to go in alone, I followed.
Stay in the car and keep the doors locked,
Hopley shouted to Marguerite. Without hesitation, he opened the door, bearing a cross held out in front of him like a shield. The whole house was dark, except for the kitchen, where one aged ceiling bulb bathed the room in a sickly yellow light. I tried the living room light switch, but it was of no use. I pulled a lighter out of my pockets and ignited it, generating a small flicker of warm orange light. Hopley led while I followed. The living room furniture had been toppled and ripped open, stuffing strewn about, and our feet crunching broken glass from the abused lamp that had sat in the corner. Walls had holes smashed in. We went to every room, seeing furniture tossed, ripped, scratched, walls bludgeoned and battered. The whole time I was shaking like a leaf. Every time I heard an odd sound, I got startled, staring at whichever direction it came from until I was sure no shrieking, emaciated boy wielding a knife would slash my throat. It did not help that all through this, Hopley was shouting loudly for James to come out unarmed and commanding the devil to relinquish his hold over the boy, adding in a Hail Mary or the Lord's Prayer between his commands. I had an impatient, wild desire to grab Father Hopley by the neck in order to get him to be quiet. The house was not large by any means, so when we couldn't find James in our initial search, we had the daunting task of conducting a more thorough search. When we had to look under the beds, I fully expected cold steel to get embedded into my eyes or my arm. But the bed hid nothing, perplexing us further and putting me on the brink.
Do you think he went out the window?
I whispered.
If he's fled outside, he could be miles away from here by now. We need to get the police.
He has to be here,
Hopley insisted.
Has to be. There isn't a single open window anywhere in this house.
My mind was at a loss. Could he have closed them on his way out? It'd throw us off? Hopley looked skeptical of my query.
We can check the windows for signs of disturbance, if you wish, but we're likely wasting time. He has to be somewhere in this house.
The two of us went window to window, seeing they were all locked, making it unlikely that they had been tampered with. When there were only the kitchen windows left to check, Father Hopley inspected while I guarded the front entrance to make sure there were no surprises sneaking up on us from behind. Then the refrigerator door opened. James spilled out of it, various vegetables and other foods tumbling out alongside him. In his right hand, light reflecting off the large butcher knife he held. He scrambled to his feet and made a guttural scream before charging Hopley. The fridge door had opened out towards me, and I barreled right into it, a knot forming on my knee and throbbing in pain as I rushed to make sure Father Hopley wasn't slashed to death. I managed to grab James by his right shoulder, and he skidded to a stop as Hopley held his arms out to protect himself. James twisted himself around, swinging the knife as he did so. I leapt out of the way, and he had barely missed my gut. Raising his arm up to jab me, I grabbed his right hand with both of mine, barely keeping the knife away from my head while he mercilessly punched and kicked me. Thankfully, Father Hopley grabbed him, and we wrestled him to the ground while he bellowed incredibly loud yells. I have no idea how we managed to pry the knife out of his hands, but we did. Out of danger, we noticed that, despite not getting stabbed, there were bloodstains on our clothes and hands. We realized quickly that the wounds had come from James. His body was covered in shallow cuts, his knuckles were scabbed over and bleeding anew, and bruises pockmarked him all over. The knife, too, had crusty, dry blood on it. We managed to drag the poor kid to his room and lock him back up. Drained, we shambled back to our car when Marguerite got out of the car and hurried over to us.
"Oh my goodness, you're..."
she began, but I cut her off. "We're fine, thank you. James is in his room. We'll be going now," I said. The two of them just stood there, looking at me like I had grown green skin and tentacles. I didn't care. I was tired, filthy, and still had lingering fear for my own safety, knowing that James could spontaneously leave his room at any time. I sat in the driver's seat of the car, waiting for Father Hopley to say his goodbyes, return the key, and get in. Silence weighed the air down for a solid 5 minutes as I drove us back home. Father Hopley pierced that silence with an accusatory sentence.
"You didn't have to be so rude to her, Brother Colin."
"And you didn't have to charge in there like some Alvin York wannabe," I said, glaring at the road ahead.
"What was I supposed to do then? Hang up on her? Say it's not a problem? Just abandon that poor woman when she needed us most?" he said, raising his voice.
"You could have died there, Father," I said, avoiding a direct question. "I could have died. We both could have died. What do you think would have happened if I hadn't caught that kid in time? What would you have done if he had sliced my stomach open and my intestines spilled out all over the floor and I was bleeding to death?" I was shouting now, all the pent-up frustrations from the months of physical violence and lack of progress taking its toll. Father Hopley scrunched his lips together like he had bit down on a particularly sour lemon. Instead of remaining silent like I hoped, he said,
"I hope I don't need to remind you that as God's messenger on earth, we're granted immortal life in heaven once our mortal forms are gone. I acted in the faith that God would protect me against the devil's evil forces. If not here on earth, then in my immortal soul. Maybe you need to put more trust in the Almighty. Then you won't act so disrespectfully in my presence." I grit my teeth in sheer anger. I was at a loss of what to say in retort, settling for something that I hoped would make him understand why he was being so bullheaded.
"You may not be afraid to gamble with your own life, Father," I said with deliberate slowness, "but that gives you no right to put others in danger."
"Nobody made you go,"
he shouted back, making me recoil. He shifted uncomfortably in his seat and looked out the window. I declined to say anything in response. I dropped Father Hopley off at his residence without saying a word. When I showed up to Sunday Mass next, I wasn't expecting anything unusual in Father Hopley's sermon, but life intended to continuously subvert my expectations.
"Brothers and sisters," he said while up on the church pulpit, "I must regretfully inform you that there is a grave matter in our humble community that, as of late, has required my attention. There is a child in a home not far from here who has recently been under the control of the devil himself."
I stared blankly in shock as Hopley talked, at length, about the exorcism we were involved with. Although he did not mention me or anyone else by name, referring to me only as an aide during his speech. bile collected in my stomach as I heard him make embellishments and distortions. Objects levitating, backward speeches, and entire sentences spoken in Latin rather than a couple words here and there. A supposed chill whenever we walked in. On and on. It was like we had attended two different exorcisms. My face slowly became flush in anger. When the service was concluded, he started mingling with the parish, and as I pushed past them, I could hear their exclamations of awe and good wishes and other excitable and nervous chatter. And he was lapping it up, smiling and thanking people for their support. I had it. "Father, can I have a private word?" I asked, glaring down at him. The smile left his face, and he looked very uncomfortable. He excused himself from his parish, and we entered a back room to talk. "What are you doing?" I asked. "Father, you understand we can get into a lot of trouble if the church finds out we're operating without approval, right?"
"Now you listen here," he said.
But I cut him off. "No, you listen. You're acting recklessly. We can get kicked out of the church over this. Doesn't any of this worry you? Did you even ask Marguerite's approval to talk about her son so publicly? What compelled you to do this, that stunt?" I said, trying not to shout.
"Listen here, boy," he began,
face scrunched and sweaty.
"Everything I've done for the Lord. I may have to bend the rules a little bit as part of my service as a holy man, but you can bet that when my time comes, the Lord will welcome me as one of his own."
I was thoroughly disgusted at how flippant he was acting. I told him, "You can risk your own career and reputation doing this, Father, but I won't be tarred by association. I quit. Find another assistant, or preferably, do this by yourself." I started to walk away, intending to put the whole thing behind me, then and there. But Hopley said one more thing that gave me pause.
"You'd best not make an enemy of me, boy. A priest's word still carries a great deal of weight in polite society. I hadn't used your name up on the pulpit, but by God, if you walk away from this, you will see how much your reputation will be risked."
I stopped dead in my tracks. I wasn't sure how dangerous the curmudgeon's threat truly was, but looking over my shoulder at Father Hopley and seeing his smug grin crinkling his face assured me he would try to make good on it. Deflated, I silently shuffled out of there, my skin itching with revulsion at the revelation of what this man I trusted really was. I weighed my options. I considered contacting someone higher up in the church, but agonized over whether they would side with me. A young aide who had attended secular education over someone who had been a priest for almost 3 decades. At best, I'd be destroying both of our lives. And at worst, I'd be ignored, and Father Hopley would just keep visiting James in secret, possibly roping someone else into becoming an aide. Morosely, I convinced myself that continuing with the exorcism was the best out of several bad options. At the time, I was still convinced that, stunt or no stunt, Hopley and I were still treating a boy who was possessed, or at the very least, seriously ill. Marguerite seemed unlikely to take her son back to any mental institution, considering the failures they had delivered her, leaving us as James's only form of contact with the outside world. So, I continued. Our subsequent drives to the house were lacking in small talk. Another week of rites. Then another. And then, 3 weeks after Hopley's speech, and 4 months after we began, was our last session. As before, he struggled. He screamed. I went to grab him, and he quickly reached into the backside of his pants, pulling out a revolting, mushy, brown handful of fecal matter, which he proceeded to smear against my face when I got in range. I screamed in a combination of fear, nausea, and rage as the feces dripped down the side of my face. When James tried to push past me and charge at Father Hopley, he tumbled, and unfortunately, landed face first. Screaming anew, we picked him up together to see that his nose had been broken and was bleeding. Marguerite cried out, seeing it.
"What did you do that for?"
Hopley screamed at me.
"I didn't. It was..."
I stopped, taking in equal parts guilt and shame.
"Let's get him on the bed. Hopefully you can do that without trying to kill the poor boy."
Hopley snarled. Indeed, we got him restrained without too much incident. The bloody nose had taken most of the fight out of him, it had seemed. I took the opportunity to excuse myself thereafter and get cleaned up, mindful of the glares following me. I washed my face as thoroughly as I could with the amenities provided. I wanted to vomit, but managed to hold myself together just enough. I stared at my still wet face in the mirror, searching carefully for any flecks of feces I had missed in my scrubbing. Satisfied that I was clean, I noticed that there was a small scrape on my cheek. It must have happened in the scuffle. So, to make extra sure I wouldn't get an infection, I opened up the medicine cabinet, looking for rubbing alcohol. A wide array of pill bottles greeted me. Lithium. I became curious enough to open a pill bottle, seeing most of it was empty. Then I opened another, and another, and another. It was the same story each time. Before I could dwell on it for too long, I heard Father Hopley shout,
"Call an ambulance."
I rushed out of the bathroom and saw Marguerite in the hallway, shrieking in front of James's door while Hopley pushed past her.
"What happened?" I asked. "What's going on?"
I nudged my way beside Marguerite and saw James on the bed, blood gushing out of his mouth in great rivers while his eyes rolled in the back of his head and he was convulsing horribly. I went at once to the living room, where Hopley was busy punching in the numbers for 911.
"What happened, Father?"
I asked, horrified.
"The boy bit his tongue," he snapped. "Now go. Go help him."
He turned away from me and spoke frantically into the receiver. I left him to go check on James, only to see Marguerite running in with wads of toilet paper in hand. Mystified, I went in after her, to see her shoving the wads right down his throat, just one after another, with a manic energy about her.
"Marguerite, what are you doing?"
I shouted. I ran over and tried to pull her hands away, which she resisted greatly. I did, however, manage to pry her away, to which she responded with wails and tears.
"I have to stop the bleeding. I have to stop the bleeding,"
she said in her hysterics.
"Calm down. Just calm down,"
I implored.
"We can help him together. I just need you to..."
I stopped, noticing a gurgling, coughing sound. I looked over to James to see that he was tensing up, moving slower and slower with each gag.
"He's choking," I said. "Quick, let's get him up."
I moved to undo the restraints, only for Marguerite to try and stop me.
"No, we can't," she said. "He could attack us as soon as he's out. It's too dangerous."
I didn't have time for such nonsense. So over her protests, I started undoing the restraints anyway. That's when Father Hopley made his presence known.
"Stop what you're doing, Brother Colin," he commanded.
"Father, this kid's going to die if we don't do something soon."
"The risk to the rest of us is simply too great to ignore," he lectured. "Thus, we must keep the boy under restraints."
"He's dying, for Christ's sake,"
I yelled at the top of my lungs, but neither of them seemed particularly moved by my words. I felt like a kid lost in a forest, groping for some words that would impress upon them the seriousness of the situation. It was like they lost their minds. I started doing compressions, hoping to revive the kid. Marguerite and Hopley just watched, awkwardly. I had them switch out with me when my arms became excessively tired. I wished that the ambulance would come quicker. When the paramedics did arrive and stream into the house, they undid the restraints and started hauling the poor boy away while Hopley answered their questions. One of them asked about the bruises and the cuts.
"He hurts himself, sir,"
Marguerite piped up. The paramedic raised an eyebrow at that. The police had accompanied the paramedics, and they too started asking questions. The next few hours, days, and weeks were just a long days. All of us were questioned at some point. James had been declared DOA. Cause of death from asphyxiation related to choking. They charged Marguerite, of course. She pleaded not guilty, but the true bombshell was what she claimed as her defense. She claimed Father Hopley had approached her, conned her, really, into going along with an exorcism, with the understanding that the subsequent fame it would provide the both of them would be used to fund effective treatment for James. The outbursts were all staged, prompted by the medical cocktail she had fed him. She confessed that the strange going on at the house, dying vegetation and small animals around the property, were faked and part of this scheme, and I was at the center of it all, someone they intended to dupe into corroborating what had gone down. The magnitude of the lies I had been fed made my head spin. I felt unclean, knowing how close they had been to roping me into their egotistical scheme. Assuming Marguerite was right, of course. Father Hopley unsurprisingly denied everything, claiming Marguerite had fabricated a story and led him on with the false pretense of performing a genuine exorcism. I testified, told them about Hopley's backroom strong-arming of me, his eagerness to go on without official approval, so on and so forth. He was given a 4-year sentence for child endangerment. Marguerite got 9. After the trial was over, wanting to put the whole tragedy behind me, I moved hundreds of miles away. I started a new life teaching kids in private school. Not a single day goes by that I don't think about James Trenton, or the hell that he endured because of my inaction, my stupidity, my arrogance in thinking we were saving him from a crueler fate. And so, I make this confession. God forgive me.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.